It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a tour of Wisconsin farmers markets, big and small, and find out what it takes for them to succeed. First, it's time to check in on some of the week's top news in national politics. The trial of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort continued this week. The president is commenting on a 2016 meeting between members of his campaign and a Russian lawyer. And election results are in, some of them, in races around the country for Congress, races for governor, and more. Our question for you this week, with the midterm elections now just a few months away, do you predict a Democratic wave, or will Republicans maintain the control they have now at the federal level and in most states? If you're a Republican voter, what do you think the party should focus on? Are you worried? How should President Trump figure into campaigns? If you lean toward the Democrats, how left should the party go to energize voters? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is The Hill's national correspondent and the author of Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this Manafort trial. President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, on trial this week for charges of tax evasion and bank fraud. Big moments, the testimony of Rick Gates, Manafort's former associate, another member of the Trump campaign at one point. What kind of stuff are we hearing at this trial, Reed?
So we're not hearing a lot about President Trump himself, but we are hearing about the legendary exploits of Paul Manafort. This is a guy who's been around American politics and Republican circles for about 30 years now, and he has gotten involved as well in campaigns overseas, which is not terribly uncommon in and of itself. What is uncommon is that prosecutors allege he squirreled away tens of millions of dollars, didn't report that income to the IRS, and didn't report that he was working for foreign governments and foreign interests while lobbying here in the United States. So we've heard testimony from a number of bookkeepers and accountants and experts at the Treasury Department and things like that about why or what happened and how he possibly broke the law. And we also heard this week, as you say, from Rick Gates, who is not just an associate, but was almost a mentee of Paul Manafort's for a very long time, worked for him for years. And then when Manafort went to become President Trump's campaign chairman, Gates went and worked on the campaign as well, ended up becoming the executive director of the transition, which is, no small feat. I mean, that's a big deal as the administration was staffing up. This is after Paul Manafort was fired from his job as the campaign chairman. Gates testified that Manafort had directed him in a bunch of illegal activity, and that he had he himself had engaged in illegal activity, including skimming some money from Manafort through sort of padding his expense reports to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. This has been a pretty dramatic trial, and one that is, if Paul Manafort is found guilty, he's likely to go away to prison for quite a significant period of time. This, though, is about the larger effort of getting Manafort to flip and to share whatever information he knows with Robert Mueller's prosecutors about President Trump and what President Trump knew and when.
Yeah, the president has tweeted about what he characterizes unfair treatment of Paul Manafort, saying Al Capone hadn't been treated as badly as Manafort is. Some people read that as a signal that, hey, if it comes down to it, the president would be willing to pardon Manafort. That's speculation from some political observers at this point. But as you say, in the trial itself, there's not a whole lot about the Trump campaign. A little bit of mention, but that's not the focus in this particular trial.
Yeah, and that tells me that there is more to come about President Trump's campaign, at least. I don't, we can't say that there's anything to come about the president himself, but it's clear that Robert Mueller's investigation has these tentacles that are going out in a lot of different directions. This is just the first and most public one we know. He has, a dozen or more prosecutors who are working on other elements of this investigation. So, for all of what the president and the White House say they want this thing wrapped up quickly, I don't think this is going to wrap up particularly quickly. We may have a few more, Friday news dumps on this before this whole thing wraps up.
Another thread in this whole thing is this now famous 2016 meeting at Trump Tower between campaign officials, including the president's son, and this Russian lawyer offering apparently damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Now, the president tweeted over the last week. This got a lot of attention. Here's the tweet. This was a meeting to get information on an opponent, totally legal and done all the time in politics, and it went nowhere. I did not know about it, quoting from President Trump's tweet on that. A lot of people took that as an admission that this was seeking information from the Russians about the Clinton campaign, which had previously been denied as a motivation for this particular meeting.
Yeah, and for whether or not you like President Trump at all, it's clear that he has not told the truth about this meeting, because we've got about 17 different explanations about what this meeting was about. First of all, we heard it was all about adoptions from Russia and the Magnitsky Act. And second of all, then we heard that that President Trump may have known about it later. And then the president dictated a misleading statement while on Air Force One, by the way, coming back from Europe, about Don Jr., his son's involvement in this meeting. So the shifting sands of explanations on all this really raised questions, in my mind at least, about sort of how far do we go? You know, why should we believe that he didn't know about this meeting when he has changed his tune on so many other things about this? Of course, this meeting is central to Mueller's investigation into whether or not the campaign colluded with Russia. We'll see whether or not he's able to come to any legal conclusions about that. But the fact is, there are shifting explanations, and the president has not told the truth on that. That is demonstrable from his own statements, not from, you know, anonymous sources or anything like that. It is simply a fact that he has said many different things about this one particular meeting, and now he's adopted this line that collusion is not a crime, which is remarkable because he's spent months saying there is no collusion, there was no collusion. Look, he's right about the fact that campaigns look into what their opponents have done, both domestically and overseas. But the fact is, it's, you know, the president has now basically admitted that his campaign folks, including Paul Manafort, who was in that meeting, including Jared Kushner, who was in that meeting, including Don Jr., who was in that meeting, at least engaged with Russian officials trying to find information about his opponent. That's something that he's denied for more than a year.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, about some of the top stories in national politics. Reed, let's turn to yesterday's elections. The story's not completely done. Who knows, something might break as we're talking on this. People have been watching these special congressional elections, and we have one last one. I believe it's the last one in Ohio's 12th district. It's been a heavily Republican district, a long time since a Democrat has won that. What happened there? Why are we paying such close attention?
So this is a district that was left vacant when the incumbent member decided to quit and take another job with a business group back home. It is a district that is in basically the Columbus suburbs and exurbs, sort of north of Columbus, Ohio, and a little bit to the east. It's a district that went for President Trump by 11 points back in 2016, and the Republican candidate this time around, a guy named Troy Balderson, appears to have won by about 1,700 votes out of around about 200,000 cast. 1,700 votes in an election that big, that's not a lot, and especially in a district that President Trump won by 11 points. If we apply that same sort of margin, you know, a Democrat outperforming Hillary Clinton by that much, there are 40 or 45 seats around the country that are less Republican than this particular district. National Republicans threw the House at trying to win this seat. They spent millions of dollars. They sent hundreds of volunteers into the field. They don't have the amount of money they need to defend all 45 of those seats to that same degree come November's midterm election. So this hints at Democratic enthusiasm to actually show up to vote, and it gives a sense that Republicans face a really difficult landscape here. They avoided what could have been an absolute catastrophe by losing this seat if in fact, Balderson holds on as they count the final few hundred ballots here. In talking to a lot of my Republican friends today, they're taking a message about this. They realize that Republicans are they need to be motivated to show up to vote. They're not feeling that motivation right now, and that could put a lot of seats at risk come November. Remember, Democrats only have to win back 24 House seats to win back the majority in Congress. There are 25 seats that voted for Hillary Clinton back in 2016 that elected a Republican congressman at the same time. Those are the prime targets, but there are a lot more seats that are far less Republican than this the open seat in Columbus was, which tells me that the landscape this year is pretty broad.
We're looking at the top national political stories of the week with Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. We're going to talk some more about election results and what lies ahead in November. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, hopes, and fears for Election Day in November. Are you seeing a blue wave on the way, a red wall, a purple swamp? I made that one up today. What's going to make the difference? If you lean toward one party or the other, what do you want to see your candidates, your party, talking about? If you're a Republican, how does the party make the case? Should President Trump be heavily involved or stay well clear? Democrats, should your party go to the more progressive wing, reach for the center? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, checking in on some of the top national stories in politics. You can join in on your election questions, hopes, predictions, 800-642-1234. Staying with elections, Reed, a primary in the race for governor in Kansas, the president weighed in on the last at the last minute in some ways. What happened?
The president, this is remarkable. So we just put up a story about this a few minutes ago. President Trump has been much more aggressive about weighing in on contested primaries than any other president in my memory. I mean, George W. Bush didn't do this. Barack Obama didn't do this. But President Trump has no problem throwing around his endorsement and trying to remake the Republican Party in his own image. In this case, he endorsed against the sitting governor of Kansas. That is way outside the sort of political norms. This is a guy named Jeff Collier, who was elevated to the governorship when Trump picked his predecessor, Sam Brownback, for an ambassadorship. Collier's been in office for, 8, 9 months now. And President Trump endorsed his opponent, Kris Kobach, the firebrand Secretary of State, a very conservative guy both on immigration issues and on voting rights issues, for the governorship. The polls closed last night, and I thought this was going to be a blowout, that Kobach was going to walk away with it, given President Trump's power within the Republican Party. But he didn't, and Kobach is leading now by about 191 votes out of 250,000 or more cast, which is, you know, a very tiny margin. That's even closer than that Ohio race we were talking about. There are still thousands of provisional ballots and absentee ballots to count, so it could in fact flip, and we could see, but the bottom line is we see a very tight race here between an arch conservative and somebody who is much more sort of traditional Republican, despite President Trump weighing in. And I think that shows sort of the extent of his power. He's able to fire up the conservative base, but, you know, there are some Republicans who are much more comfortable with sort of that traditional type that Governor Collier represents.
Bring on a caller. We invited your calls on the elections this year at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Thanks for having me on. I understand that the party that's on the outs during an off-year election usually has a benefits, but it wasn't the problem for the Democrats in 2016 is that they had a candidate and the titular head of their party under federal investigation, and now we hear in 2018 with a titular head, well, the head of the Republican Party, President Trump, under federal investigation, and that this is hurting the good economic news for him, and it is undermining his party's chances. The issue of a wave aside, that'll be interesting. Your commentator's response. Thank you,
Jim. Thanks for the call. Will the ongoing investigations of President Trump and his campaign and the overall Russia probe be something that hurts Republicans this year?
Yeah, it certainly could be, Jim. And if Robert Mueller decides to drop some kind of bombshell before the campaign, before the midterm elections actually happen, yeah, that could swing a lot of votes. However, I think there's a broader picture here that's sort of already baked in. Republicans absolutely love President Trump. Democrats absolutely loathe President Trump. And those in the middle are probably more on the Democratic side than on the Republican side at the moment, given where his approval rating is. If I had told you that, 2 years ago, that in the midterm elections, the stock market would be up, 5,000 points since the last presidential election, unemployment rate would be plumbing, new depths, all-time lows. In Wisconsin, it is actually the lowest rate that it's been since the Bureau of Labor Statistics started keeping track back in 1976. If I told you that, you know, GDP was growing at north of 4% on an annualized basis, you would say, boy, the incumbent party, the party that just did all that, is going to have a really great year. Well, the fact is they're not going to have a really great year, and that's largely, I think, because President Trump's approval rating is simply so lousy. He is such a polarizing figure. Again, Republicans absolutely love him, but Democrats and those in the middle don't. His approval rating is somewhere between 40 and 45%. Historically speaking, that's better than George W. Bush's was back in 2006, which was a big Democratic year, but it's not as good as President Obama's was in 2010, which was a good year for Republicans. So that tells me that the sort of the conversation about President Trump is largely already baked into where we stand today. The big things that could change are, yes, the Mueller investigation, but how many people does that actually convince to vote for President Republicans or for Democrats? I'm not really sure. I don't think it's a huge number. The other thing that could change is that economic number. If we start to see numbers going down, maybe because of Trump's trade war or because of just sort of the natural cycle of the economy, high gas prices that we're seeing this summer, something like that, that could scare voters even more. Those voters who sort of like what the president's doing on the economy, if the economy goes south, boy, that base is going to fall away real quick.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at the latest news in national politics. Reed, we've been talking about races for Congress. You wrote a piece on how all this translates into races for state legislatures. And now Republicans have run the table in a couple of midterm elections. They control a huge number of chambers and state legislatures around the country, including both of them here in Wisconsin. You talk to people from both parties. What are they looking at?
And I talked to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss of Wisconsin, who, you know, openly acknowledged, just like a lot of other Republicans do, that there is a level of Democratic enthusiasm that they can't ignore, that they have to pay attention to. Republicans control 68 of the 99 state legislative chambers across the country. That's pretty near an all-time high, as best I can tell, in sort of the modern era. And they have basically won so much in recent years, and they've got such a huge advantage over Democrats, that there's going to be a natural ebb. They're going to give back some of those gains simply because they won in territory that they probably had no business winning in the first place. But because of President Trump's approval rating, they could give back a lot more. State legislators are sort of the least able to control for the national environment. They've got less money than somebody running for Congress or a U.S. Senate seat, and they are far less known. You know, how many listeners can actually say who their state representative is? Now, there have been times in my life when I wasn't entirely sure, even though I cover this stuff. But when we think about those state legislators across the country, you know, we could, because of President Trump's approval rating, if a national wave does in fact build, we could be talking about Republicans losing 500, 600, maybe 700 seats. President Obama, in his first midterm, lost 708 seats in state legislatures. That came right at the time before legislatures started redrawing district lines, and that's the reason this thing really matters. We're going into another redistricting cycle. If Democrats can balance out the playing field, win back a lot of the seats that they lost, then they'll have a much stronger hand when it comes to redrawing both legislative and congressional district lines after the census in 2020.
Strategy-wise, are people in either party talking about, hey, we're going to try to localize this thing, or we're going to mention President Trump for good or ill?
Yeah, we hear a lot of legislators talking about the local issues that they want to talk about and their plans for the future. Robin Voss told me, I thought this was a good line, he said about two-thirds of your campaign should be about the future, one-third of your campaign should be about the past. So talk about what you've done a little bit and then talk about what you're going to do a lot. So we're going to hear a lot about localized issues. You know, in Wisconsin, you're going to hear about that low unemployment rate. You're going to hear about Foxconn coming to Wisconsin. You're going to hear about cutting taxes and what Governor Walker's administration has been able to do. On the other hand, in talking to, you know, primary voters around the country, I've been struck by how much people are thinking about President Trump, even when they're voting for things like governor's races. I mean, how many governors end up being a direct, you know, challenge to the president of the United States? The answer is not many. But people are thinking about Trump, and that means that Democrats are going to be able to talk about Trump when they want to as a cudgel against Republicans in the same way that Republicans talked about Obama or used to talk, or still talk about Nancy Pelosi when they're talking about Democratic candidates, sort of lumping them all together. And Republicans are going to have to figure out a way to say, look, I support the president when he's right and I oppose him when he's wrong, and not, you know, turn off their own base while doing so. So it's a tough balancing act. When the shoe was on the other foot, when Republicans had the advantage in 2010, they stormed to a big win by talking a lot about President Obama and specifically the Affordable Care Act. We'll see if Democrats can convert the same sort of energy into gains on their side.
I want to touch on a policy issue. The Trump administration this week is calling for changes now to fuel economy requirements in the auto industry, the whole country overriding California exemptions. What changes?
So the Obama administration wanted to roughly double the miles per gallon standards that cars and light trucks and things like that have to adhere to by 2025, ratcheting up the mile per gallon standard to about 36 miles per gallon. The Trump administration wants to freeze that hike at the 2021 level, which would be at about 30 miles per gallon. So still higher than it is today, but not as high as possible. The Trump administration says they want to do this because basically, as manufacturers build lighter cars, those cars can be more prone to accidents and deaths on the highways. A lot of experts don't actually think that that is, in fact, the case. Under the Clean Air Act, California has the authority to set its own pollution rates, and the administration wants to end that. But that's going to be pretty difficult to do. That would likely take an act of Congress. And California, of course, plans to fight as strong as possible to keep their own ability to regulate the commercial market. But basically, there are so many other states that follow what California does that we could end up with a country with pretty much two fuel standards, one half that would be at that 30-mile-an-hour gallon, mile-per-gallon rate, and the other half, led by California and basically blue states that follow it, would have a much higher standard. So, you know, car manufacturers are actually rallying against this proposed change. They want one standard nationwide, even if it means they've got to make more fuel-efficient cars. They still, it's better for them to have that sort of one standard.
We'll leave it there. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, in our weekly roundup of national politics. This week is National Farmers Market Week, so today we're looking at the challenges and successes of farmers markets around Wisconsin. The markets have grown in popularity over the last decade, but they often deal with tough competition and many fail in their first 4 years. Brett Shaw is an associate professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication and part of UW Extension. He's done research on farmers markets in the state. You can find his recent piece online at wiscontext.org. Brett, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, farmers markets have been taking off in the last decade around the country. In your research, the numbers have gone way up. Is that happening here in Wisconsin, too? Are we seeing just a bigger number of markets?
Yeah, we've also seen a substantial increase in farmers markets in Wisconsin. But we also find that not all farmer markets are viable, that some will start out and then after 1 to 4 years can find that they can't economically sustain themselves. And that was largely the focus of our research, which is to say that we wanted to help the farmers markets that exist to thrive and succeed in the long term.
Yeah, it might seem with a trend going on like this, so if you build it, they will come. You have that farmers market and it just kind of self-sustains. That's not really how it works, you found out.
Yeah, in larger areas like what we see in the farmers markets in Madison and other larger cities, they do tend to last a long time. But in rural and suburban areas in particular, sometimes they don't last that long and there's high market manager turnover. So we found that the type of support you provide to the farmers market should vary significantly depending on the size of the community that you're trying to support.
And you actually surveyed farmers market managers of markets big and small around the state. And it sounds like those managers need a fair amount of support, right? What kind of help are they looking for to help make their market successful?
Well, farmers market managers said that some of the areas they need the most support is one is in finding low-cost marketing strategies to attract more customers. And again, these are the ones in the suburban and rural areas. They also needed more help in terms of retaining the vendors that they have, there's a trend, and this is statewide, that the market vendors are starting to age, and they're starting to wonder, how are we going to refill these farmers market vendor slots when the current people that we have retire?
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show, the aging of Wisconsin's farmers, and I assume this is mostly farmers we're talking about as vendors. Is that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we're speaking about here. I mean, there's people that produce processed food and packaged foods, but the overwhelming majority of them sell fresh produce.
So how big a challenge is it for, especially those smaller markets we're talking about, to attract vendors who are going to come back week after week and hopefully year after year?
The ones we spoke with said it's a pretty serious challenge because the farmers market vendors that show up there aren't necessarily going to make a lot of money from showing up. A lot of it's about building community and increasing access to fresh produce. But we also find that they need to be pretty attentive to the vendor needs and being, you know, work on relationship management and make sure that the vendors that show up are having a good experience and making sufficient income to make their time showing up to the market worth it.
And actually, you touched on a good point. I think we should talk about it. On a fundamental level, what is the value of a farmer's market for a community, for the consumers, and for the vendors?
Well, there's a number of different benefits. One is social, that people have the opportunity to show up in their community, interact with farmers, interact with one another, interact with nonprofit groups and government groups that show up. There's also ecological benefits, that many of the markets that vend at the farmers markets are practicing sustainable agricultural practices, and probably most important is that for small and medium-sized farmers, they keep a much more substantial share of the profits from what they produce, and that's significant as well. And of course, another important reason is that it increases access to fresh and healthy food. So there's a number of different benefits.
Talking about farmers markets with Brett Shaw. He's been a part of research with UW Extension and UW Madison looking at the role of farmers markets and the challenges that they can face. And Brett, in some of your research, there were charts. There's a lot of variety in farmers markets. We've talked about rural, suburban, and urban, different sizes, different numbers of vendors. And that makes it seem to me like it would be hard to come up with a one-size-fits-all approach for farmers markets to meet some of these challenges.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we found. Like, for instance, the larger markets, as we discussed, aren't necessarily looking to get more people to show up their markets, but rather to spend more money at the ones that they have. The suburban markets in particular, we found, can struggle because they don't always have the same support from nonprofit groups that are looking at issues like food security and fresh food. So need to actually tailor the support we provide to farmers market managers depending on the size of the community that you're in.
And some common solutions, you mentioned marketing, and one really simple way, if people are fans of their local farmers markets, it can be as simple as spreading the word, telling people about it.
Yeah, actually, the number one thing that farmers markets managers said they wanted was support in word-of-mouth marketing. So in this world of mediated communication, you know, Facebook, all sorts of different ways to access media, we found that word-of-mouth is still the gold standard for marketing and outreach. And so, you know, just going out and talking to employers, churches, nonprofit groups, getting people to share what they, more information about the farmers market can be a really significant thing. And then lots of farmers market managers also said they wanted help in using social media platforms like Facebook more effectively, because these is also a form of word of mouth communication. So most farmers markets, except for the largest ones, don't have very large budgets for their marketing efforts. And so Facebook and other social media platforms are one inexpensive way to get the word out.
And so if somebody is a fan of their local market and they're hoping it sticks around for a couple of years, just taking a picture of their haul maybe and posting it online to share with people might be one way they can help.
Absolutely. So if you just send a picture and say, hey, at the market right now, in fact, one of the things they want that market managers want is for vendors to announce to the people that are already following the vendors' Facebook pages that make an announcement announcing that they're now at the market and it's started, because, you know, people get really busy and it serves as a reminder that the market's going on right now.
And another key seems to be partnership, because as you say in your survey, a lot of these farmers market managers might, some of them are volunteers, some of them are paid, but they only work part-time. So if they can partner with a city organization, a municipal organization, or a nonprofit, that can help spread the work and spread the word.
Yeah. So many farmers market managers said they could use a little more support by their local governments. And some of the ways that local governments could be supportive is posting signs around the community. They could also, cross-promote on social media. In some cases, they can offer free parking so that people have access, easy access to their farmers markets. So there's all kinds of ways that farmers market managers can collaborate with community organizations to make their work easier and make their markets more sustainable.
You mentioned food security and hunger earlier. And I know in your survey, you found that some but not all farmers markets make it easier for people to use SNAP and electronic benefits using cards. That's not always easy to set up. And one of the partnerships you mentioned was somebody had partnered at a farmer's market, I think it was with a credit union, to help get the card readers that people would need to do that.
Yeah, that was an interesting and effective partnership. So what the credit union did was provide the machines that make this possible. In exchange, they also were able to distribute shopping bags that were branded with their logo. And it turned out to be just an effective collaboration between the farmers market and a local business that wanted the market to succeed.
Now, suppose somebody out there is listening right now, there may be the farmers market manager, or they're a volunteer, or they're somehow involved. Are there resources they can go to help make their farmers market more successful, more long lasting?
Sure. So for one, if you want to find out more about the information in our reports, we have a WordPress site that contains all the reports that we're discussing here, and that can be Googled or, you know, looked for on any search engine. There's also a Wisconsin Farmers Market Association that is organized by the University of Wisconsin Extension, and that's something else that can be accessed to get more information about how to support your local farmers market.
And we'll have links to some of your research at wiscontext.org. Brett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Brett Shaw, Environmental Communications Specialist for UW Extension and Associate Professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication, with us to talk about some of the challenges of running a farmer's market. Wisconsin's unemployment rate is 2.9%, just a bit higher than the record low 2.8% this spring. And last year, our labor participation rate was one of the highest in the nation at about 68%. But a new report shows that it's been steadily declining over the past couple of decades. And that's not just a Wisconsin thing. The national labor participation rate has been down as well. One theory, able-bodied potential workers are sitting on the sidelines. But according to this report, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. Matt Curis is the Community Development Specialist with the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. He's the co-author of the report, Windicators, Labor Participation Trends in Wisconsin. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we've touched on this in the past on the show, the labor participation rate, but dig into it a little. What does this mean? How do we measure it?
Sure. The participation rate differs from the unemployment rate in that it captures the number of individuals that are either actively employed or unemployed and looking for a job. So it's the share of the population that's actively engaged in the labor force, where the unemployment rate only captures those individuals that are looking for a job.
And this can muddy the waters when we just look at the unemployment number. Sometimes if unemployment goes down, that could mean more people have jobs. It could mean more people have given up looking for jobs. That latter tends to happen when the economy's bad.
That's correct. And one of the things that we've seen recently in Wisconsin is that we have seen the unemployment rate tick down historically over the last 20 years or so, but we're seeing it come back up across a number of different demographic categories.
Right. So who is not participating in the workforce? And you break this down by age in particular. Who is not participating in the workforce as much as they used to, say, in the pre-Great Recession days?
Well, one of the big downward trends we've seen is among individuals ages 16 to 19. And that's certainly gone down since the Great Recession, and it's actually rebounded a little bit more recently. But it's a long-term trend that's actually occurred since the 1980s. And we've also seen individuals aged 25 to 54 have declined in participation rates over the last 20 years or so, but we're starting to see those come back up as well.
Let's look at those younger people. 16 to 19, I think, was the number. That could be bad news, the young slackers, I guess. But in your report, you say, no, it's people not dropping out of school or maybe more prone to seek higher education that keeps them from pursuing jobs right away.
That's right. And certainly there may be some individuals that are sitting on the sidelines of that age group, but we have seen dropout rates declining over the last several decades, both in Wisconsin and nationally. We've also seen the number of college enrollments increasing. So that means that people, instead of opting for opportunities in the workforce, are instead opting for opportunities in education.
Now, let's key in on that 25 to 54, because that, as I understand, that's prime time for working. That's when we're expecting people to have the highest participation in the workforce. What have we seen there in ups and downs over the last couple of decades?
Well, a lot of individuals have looked at men aged 25 to 54 and looked at kind of the long-term decline in participation rates among those individuals. And indeed, we have seen participation rates of men 25 to 54 drop over the past two decades. A lot of the attention has been focused on the drop since the Great Recession, and certainly we did see a greater decline during the recessionary period and in the recovery period. But right now, in Wisconsin at least, we are back to pre-recessionary levels for that prime working age male population.
And we, looking at charts, we tend to track the national average when it comes to labor participation rates. We have higher participation rates at a pretty consistent level. They go down nationally, they go down here, but we stay a little higher. Do I have this right?
You are correct, Rob. And we've seen this for quite some time now, over the past three or four decades. We have been in the top 10 for participation rates when compared to all states in the nation. And we do tend to track the national rate for some manner, but we are above it in almost every single demographic category that we track.
We're talking about labor participation, who's in the workforce, with Matt Curis, a co-author of a report. He's with UW Extension's Center for Community and Economic Development. So there's this kind of mystery or concern, Matt, that the economy is doing better, unemployment is down, employers are having a harder time finding workers, and we have this labor shortage. Some people are saying, okay, it's because people, especially in those prime working years, are on the sidelines. People who could work aren't seeking to work. That's not what you're seeing in this report?
We're seeing a little bit of that, but it's not contributing as much as we think to the shortage of labor in the state of Wisconsin. So, for instance, if we had the same participation rate among 25 to 54-year-olds, or the prime working age population, as we had back in the year 2000, which is essentially when it peaked from the state of Wisconsin and the United States, we'd only add about an additional 25,000 workers to the workforce in the state of Wisconsin. The bigger story there is that our age structure is changing in the state of Wisconsin. In the last decade alone, due to the aging of our population, we've seen about 150,000 fewer people in that age group because of their aging out of our population.
Right. And I've buried the lead a little bit because I was working up to this point. That seems like it's the big story. We have a higher proportion of people in that 60 plus range. They understandably work at there's a lower percentage of them in the workforce. That is switching our job situation in Wisconsin.
That's correct. And one of the trends we've actually seen that's probably made it probably not quite as bad in the state as we would expect is that we've seen participation rates among individuals age 65 and older actually increasing, as well as participation rates among individuals 55 to 64. So had those participation rates not increased over the last decade or so, there'd be even fewer people in the workforce than there are now.
So let's start to talk about what this means for policies. Because if the story was, okay, these 25 to 54-year-olds, they're not coming into the workforce for whatever reason. They're sitting on the sidelines, as people are saying. That leads you to do one thing. If the question is, we have more people who are older and thus less likely to come into the workforce, that means something different from a policy angle.
That's absolutely correct. What it means is that we have to think more strongly about attraction. How do we get more workers to the state of Wisconsin? We actually do a fairly good job of retaining individuals. Our out-migration rates are really not that high compared to a lot of other places, but we don't do a very good job of attracting them from other places. I think another policy discussion that needs to occur in the state is how do we think more about things like automation? Automation is something that's scary to a lot of people, but at the end of the day, I think it's going to have to be part of the solution for a lot of industries and a lot of employers in the state.
If the core story here is demographics, our population is on average getting older. I mean, that's hard to fight from a policy angle, it seems to me.
That's right. Certainly, we can try and do more to attract folks to the state of Wisconsin, get more workers here, but we're going to have to think about how this structural issue faces us just beyond getting more people to the state of Wisconsin.
This is a national policy issue, might be beyond our control in Wisconsin. Some people have said, okay, the answer is, if we're not luring younger people from elsewhere in the United States, is the answer to look at young people coming from outside the United States. Could immigration potentially fill this worker gap in those lower age ranges?
I certainly think immigration has to be a greater conversation that we have. As you noted, it is more of a federal issue right now, but I do think it's going to have to be part of the solution for a number of industries in the state.
Is there something to be done by harnessing those older workers? You mentioned that, and we actually did a whole segment on this yesterday, more people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, higher percentages in the workplace than in the past. Can we keep tapping that reserve of workers?
Certainly you have seen, as you mentioned, the number of individuals aged 55 to 64 and 65 and older staying in the workforce. And they do that for a variety of reasons. Some of it is financial or economic. They may not have the retirement savings they thought they would have and need to stay in the workforce. But I think for a lot of individuals, they just simply want to be engaged and part of a community and part of an economy. So those individuals, I think, do provide an opportunity for us to increase our workforce going forward. The challenge with those individuals, as they get older, the capacity to do a job they may have been doing for 20, 30 years before then may not be the same. So how do we think about new training opportunities and new engagement opportunities for that older workforce? And when we talk about workforce development, we typically talk about younger individuals and primate working individuals, but maybe there's an opportunity for our older workforce as well.
One thing we haven't gotten into, you look in the report a little bit about women in the workplace, a big rise, I think in the 70s, I want to say, from your report, where they, more and more women came into the workforce, and without them, economic growth would have been in big trouble, it sounds like.
Yeah, we saw that in the state of Wisconsin and also across the entire United States. If you look at participation rates historically back into the 40s, you see it as a hump, essentially. We saw strong growth in participation rates among the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, peaking in the 90s, and now on the decline. And a lot of it had to do with women entering the labor force, which did drive a lot of economic growth that we saw in the United States.
Is that changing in recent years? Are we seeing men and women diverging in their labor participation?
We've seen a flattening of participation rates among women. Women tend to have a lower participation rate on average than men for a variety of factors. But we have seen mostly flattening around 80% in the state of Wisconsin over the last several decades.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you're working with the data that's out there. Is there one piece of information you wish you had that would really help flesh out the story that right now is hard for us to measure?
I think there's a lot of concern and analysis going on about how factors like disability and the opioid crisis are affecting participation rates, particularly among men in rural areas. And right now, it's really tough to tease out causality as whether or not these disability rates are affecting participation rates in one way or the other. So if we had better data on the motives and desires of individuals in those rural areas that may be dealing with those issues, that would be a great additional data set to have.
You know, if anybody's out there trying to get that kind of data?
Not off the top of my head, but I wish they were.
All right, Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Matt Curis, Community Development Specialist with the UW Extension Center for Community and Economic Development. We've been talking with him about a report on Wisconsin's declining labor participation rates. Now, you can maybe give us a little of that data if you are an employer, a worker yourself, if you've been out of the job market, coming back in. We'd love to hear your story. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or send us an email. What are you seeing in your community? Do you feel like, do you see more people going into the workforce than they were? Did you leave a higher paying job, having a hard time getting back in? Want to avoid that lower paying job? I don't know. Tell us your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's International Cat Day. Why today? I don't know. But we will celebrate with some fun facts about cats. This is courtesy of a piece by our friend Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. She wrote a piece back in 2014. I assume most of these facts are still factual. By the way, Gemma's going to be back with us to talk about science coming up on Monday. Now, the first evidence, Gemma says, of our relationship with cats, it comes from the world of archaeology. A kitten buried beside a human 9,500 years ago on the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean. And researchers say the cat must have been brought there on purpose because they had tiny boats. A cat, even a cat, couldn't stow away successfully. So somebody brought it there on purpose. So evidence that we had a cat and we wanted that cat. Now, dogs, they're descended from animals that work in packs. Think wolves. Cats are descended from solitary hunters. They work alone. They walk alone. That kind of makes sense when you think about how they behave. Outdoor cats tend to be farsighted. Indoor cats tend to be nearsighted. And cats can't focus on anything closer than a foot away on account of their proportionally really large eyes. So that's why they have the whiskers to feel stuff in that close range. They have a good sense of smell, but taste, apparently they have no receptors for sweet stuff. So if they're trying to eat your ice cream, it's for the dairy, not the sugar. All right, there's your cat facts on International Cat Day here on Central Lab. Send us some cat pictures. Email ideas@WPR.org.